Lecture 7, Andrew Marvell, Poet of the Republic.
In January 1649, Charles Stuart, that man of blood, as they called him, was formally executed. He was executed because he had, in the views of those who executed him, betrayed his country. He had led a foreign army into England to defeat it, to protect his throne and his prerogatives as he understood them. That man of blood. That's not only the blood of English people that had been effused as a result of the Second Civil War he precipitated, but blood in English, in England, even today, has a further meaning. Blood means damned. Bloody Mary, Mary Tudor in the mid-16th century, you think of Bloody Mary, I suppose, as a cocktail. A Bloody Mary is a woman of blood, a woman who is damned. He was tried and executed with his crown on. The kingship went with his person. And there were basically two reasons for this: the betrayal of his country and the inability to imagine any king who would do otherwise, or who might do otherwise, with a similar kind of power. To protect the nation, it was felt by conservatives, we had to eliminate the king. The elect nation can only survive without its crown. There was another way of thinking about it, a more radical one, that this was the beginning of a new era for mankind. The millennium was in the offing. A new era of social justice. England's new order would be the model to nations, exactly as it had been said in Isaiah. The king and the crown had to go to preserve the elect nation and for more radical people to realize its destiny. And with the king went something else. With the king went the House of Lords, his minions, his cronies. England was now a free state, as they proclaimed it. It was now, as they said, a commonwealth. And they used the word less frequently, but we would say it today, a republic. A new, free English republic. This is an extraordinary change. Nobody in 1642, when hostilities broke out between Parliament and the Crown, ever expected anything like this to happen. Now, all previous authority had been swept away. There was a massive crisis of authority. Why should we obey the Rump Parliament? It's called the Rump Parliament, those radical members still in the House of Commons. And Oliver Cromwell himself faced throughout his life the question, why should we obey you? On what possible basis can you be legitimate? As Andrew Marvell, at the time anguishing over what this all might mean, said in a poem, it is to ruin the great work of time. The English law had been overthrown, and to cast the kingdom into another mold. Why in the world should anyone obey the Republic? Why in the world should anyone obey Oliver Cromwell? What's more, this was a most unusual republic. Historically, both in antiquity and in modern times, republics were tiny little countries, city-states or connections and conglomerations of provinces, small districts like the Netherlands or like Switzerland. But what did we have in England? We had a huge agrarian republic. The Republicans were a minority. Every conservative history textbook tells you that. But I want to remind you that every revolution is made by minorities. In America, in France, in Russia, in Cuba, every revolution is, and for that matter, every counter-revolution is as well, both left and right. The reaction, however, was to produce an enormous amount of literature to justify a brand new kind of government. and to produce an enormous amount of literature to justify a brand new kind of government was exceedingly necessary, because the defenders of monarchy were extremely effective in their promotional literature. If Charles Stuart was that man of blood to the Republicans, to the conservatives, he was, oh, I love this, the royal martyr. His chaplain, John Gardiner, published a book called, immediately after his death, in fact it had been written beforehand in anticipation of it, Icon Basilike, the portraiture of His Sacred Majesty in his solitude and sufferings. And there on the frontispiece is Charles at prayer. And there, up in the heavens, is this great sun, the great splash, and in it, is, in the Hebrew letters, is the tetragrammaton, the sign of Yahweh and God. And as he prays, there the light from God comes down on him. What have these Republicans done? They have executed someone in the figure of Christ. It is almost as though they did it to Christ again, because they did it to his representative. They did it to a figure of God. How terrible. The typology of Christ. Christ had Charles had duplicated Christ's suffering, and the radicals had crucified him. Not only that, most extraordinarily, some conservatives were ready to go so far as to say this. Let me put it this way. The paranoid mind is not necessarily an American invention. It happens in mid-17th century England as well. William Prynne, this great defender of the elect nation, goes so far as to say, the wiping out of Charles, a Constantine. Boy, did that take an act of imagination. A latter-day Constantine, wiping him out, you know what that's done. You have strengthened Antichrist by executing the martyr king. Look about, said William Prynne, when Charles was on that scaffold and the axe fell and lopped off his head. Where was the Spanish ambassador? Well, actually, he was nowhere around, but Prynne remembered it this way. The Spanish ambassador saw the great defender of Protestantism lose his head, and he took out his sword and exulted. Aha! You see, the Republicans are working for the other side. Prynne could be paranoid enough to think that maybe Quakers, in their denial of predestination, were really Dominicans in disguise. That took a high level of paranoia. Okay, so there's a wide range of argument what to do, and the Republic is not at the advantage. And this became an acute issue. The issue was what's called the engagement controversy. Within 2 months, one had to take an oath to the present government, as it now exists without King and House of Lords, in order to hold office. Not surprisingly. And by 1650, by the next year, you had to take that oath in order to be a citizen. In other words, you had to buy into the Republic. It's not surprising. All governments in a similar situation do very much the same thing. But this raised a moral crisis of the greatest proportion. What made government legitimate? What made any government legitimate? In traditional England, people were constantly taking oaths to the king to uphold the king's justice. Moreover, in 1643, they had signed a solemn league and covenant with the Scots, which was going to resist the king, but also promised that it would protect his person. And clearly, his person was no longer protected. And finally, the great chain of being. The frame of order itself, that hierarchy in nature, that headship built into the structure of the universe, seemed to be denied. The Republic's response was this: popular sovereignty. John Milton put his pen to paper in some of the most remarkable prose. He called it the tenure of kings and magistrates, and he wrote 2 defenses of the people of England against their critics. The revolutionary forces are the people of England in arms. And that, I suggested earlier, was plausible. This was far more representative of the nation than the House of Commons. But there was a problem from arguing on the basis of popular sovereignty. Most people didn't believe in popular sovereignty. Popular sovereignty might carry the radicals, it might carry independent congregationalists, but it wouldn't carry many elements of the elite who support the republic needed, or felt it needed. We have to convince these people on other bases, not on the basis of democracy. Moreover, the republics faced another problem. There was a quick split because the republic didn't implement right away radical reforms. It didn't implement the leveler program. The levelers had been crucial in pushing through the revolution, but the leveler program was not implemented. And before too many months had passed, indeed, almost immediately, John Lilburn, the leveler, writes a pamphlet. The title says it all: England's New Chains Discovered. So not only is there a ferocious right, there's a fragmentation on the left. Gerard Winstanley would write desperately that Cromwell should implement a democratic communist republic. The engagements were not to the king, but to the people. The engagements were to the soldiers who had fought in the army and the people behind who had funded that great fight. A leveler revolt took place in 1650 and would be put down savagely. Now, how do we disarm the royalists, who are in fact constantly conspiring? How do we get unhappy Presbyterians who sided with Parliament but are not happy with the Republic not to take up arms and join them? How do we create a middle ground? Never mind the problem on the far left. There were several responses to this. John Dury, an educational reformer, wrote a book on how to teach in an apocalyptic age, and that How to Teach book, I think, is actually used, they still use it in a way, or it's one of the source books that schools of education use. He talks about how you've got to have pictures, how you've got to show and tell. You've got really the beginnings of progressive education. Progressive education, in many ways, has its roots in the apocalyptic messianic expectations of the period. And he wrote a pamphlet called A Case of Conscience Resolved. And what he argued was very simply this: nobody should resist government unless you're in office. Only officers of the state can resist government. And as there were no royalists anymore in office, you should shut up and go home. Go fishing, perhaps. Francis Rouse, another defender of Parliament, said that you have to obey any government, even if it's not legitimate, because most governments don't have a legitimate title in the first place. Where did William the Conqueror really come from? Okay? All power is from God, except destiny, except providence. Now the royalists said, get serious. A whole barrage of writers on the royalist side distinguished between ordained power and permitted power. On this basis, you should obey the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire. And is the rule of Muslims as legitimate as the rule of Christian kings? And that in England, to almost everybody, seemed to say no. But there was a curious shift. This debate about the engagement, this debate about the oath, went through a curious shift. The argument went from blind providence to human need. All government that met human needs were in some sense legitimate. That was one thrust of the argument. And then there was another argument, and these two turn out to be the crucial stuff of English political thought, that there is a prophetic process that we can analyze historically. There are reasons why, historical, social, and prophetic reasons why the monarchy fell. And that's why we have a new government today. So, two directions on where government might be. On the first part, as early as 1648, when it looked like the king might really be executed, Anthony Ascham wrote a book called Of the Confusions and Revolutions of Government. And he argued that obedience is necessary to all government if it provides protection, if it provides justice, if it is a government that will give utility. And where does this all lead? It leads to Thomas Hobbes' great book, The Leviathan. Hobbes became the leader of the engagers. Hobbes said, government is where sovereignty is. There is no oath that can possibly ever work against it. People can talk about prior rights, they can talk about possession, but he said there would perhaps be no tie on the subject's obedience at this day anywhere in the world if you took that seriously, And he wrote a huge philosophical work to show it. And that, in fact, was enormously effective. It shaped people's minds. It made a lot of people accept the government. It's interesting, if you read the government papers, there's a book by a guy called Joseph Frank, wrote one of the important books on the English newspaper, and he keeps saying that the government paper, which was called Mercurius Politicus, my God, you read these editorials, they sound like Thomas Hobbes. What he didn't realize is that they are Thomas Hobbes. The editorials were simply lifted from the Leviathan, right? I'm not sure the New York Times at its best ever quite comes up with editorials as sophisticated as this. Okay, and it had its effect. Royalists, large numbers of royalists, withdrew to write about nature. Poets like Edmund Waller and Henry Vaughan went off to commune with nature. Isaac Walton, another royalist, literally wrote a book called The Complete Angler. You remember Bush, after he got defeated, he bought some fishing rods? The royalists tend to do this, and the Republic has a chance. Others go into science. Robert Boyle, who's horrified at the sectarians, let's go in and refute them, not politically, but by studying nature and seeing how nature is incompatible with democracy and radical sectarianism. So how about the Republic? One of the key guys in the Republic was, of course, Andrew Marvell, and he would be its poet, the man who would defend it in its poetry. He was originally a royalist, but he eventually became persuaded that destiny, that the working of prophetic destiny had led to Oliver Cromwell, and he would eventually defend Oliver's protectorate. The Parliament was remarkably successful by any standard of 17th century government. In 1 year, under Cromwell's leadership, it conquered Ireland. It took Ireland in a year. Elizabeth couldn't do it in a lifetime. Medieval government had never quite done it. And if that weren't enough, what did the Rump government do under Cromwell? He went and conquered Scotland. Nobody had ever done that. And he did it in a year. My goodness, if this keeps happening each year, this is remarkable. This is providential. War was declared with the most effective, powerful commercial power in Europe, the Dutch Republic. And although that went to a standstill, it was a near-run thing. And for a while, the English and the Dutch were thinking of a kind of joint government. So dare we say the Republic had a lot going for it in terms of what it was able to do. It could raise taxes, mount an army, it could do things that traditional governments could not do in years, and sometimes never. Nothing had come near this. It had challenged and could challenge, and would continue to challenge, every power in the world. The English Republic, with these radical new armies, had now emerged for the first time as a world force. Britain really becomes an imperial power in 1651, not earlier. There would be a great burst of radicalism in 1653. The Bare Bones Parliament, it was named after Praise God Barebone, one of its members, would be set up to rebuild radical, apocalyptic England. The Parliament has been maligned ever since. It is one of the most creative parliaments in the history of the whole of Britain. It was the most radical as well. Clement Attlee's government, the socialist government in 1945, which set up the national health care system, has nothing on this government. This government wanted to expropriate tithes and redistribute them. This level of property distribution, seen in the context of the 17th century, is something else. And Oliver Cromwell, at least initially, says, and why should we not be afraid to say or think that this may be the door to usher in the things that God has promised, which have been prophesied of, which he has set the hearts of his people to wait for and expect. This Parliament will bring the millennium, he says in July, the 4th of July, 1653. And by God, that Parliament went to work with the most fascinating minds in it. But when it set about to nationalize property, to expropriate tithes, Cromwell said, his basic aristocratic nature said, I don't think that's right. We need a sober apocalypse. We need a sensible apocalypse. We need liberals, not radicals. He didn't say that, but that will translate into our vocabulary. And he dissolved the parliament at gunpoint and went on to set up a proper kind of apocalyptic government. Cromwell said to the new parliament, he proclaimed the protectorate in January of 1654, and he said in September, to the parliament, still believing in the apocalypse that lay over the horizon that men would realize, he said, "You have on your shoulders the interest of all the Christian people in the world." There's no doubt. Yes, that radical parliament failed because of its radical proposals, but we're going to have the apocalypse. We're going to have a sober apocalypse. We're going to have a world apocalypse. And the man who defended him was, I mean, there were hundreds of people defending him, but the man who was the most outstanding defender, I think, who wrote a series of poems congratulating Oliver, is the poet Andrew Marvell. And I'd like you to take a look at the poem. Maybe we can read pieces of it together. It is an extraordinary piece of work. It is one of the great poems of the 17th century. It's entitled "The First Anniversary of the Government of His Highness the Lord Protector." He wrote this in 1654, and it would be published the next year. Let's take a look at what he has to say. His opening lines, we can regard this, I suppose, as a sing-along with the Beast, okay? He says, in the opening lines, he begins, "Like the vain curlings of the watery maze, which in smooth streams a sinking weight doth raise, so man, declining, always disappears in the weak circles of increasing years, and his short tumults of themselves compose, while flowing time above his head does close." What image do we have here? We have the traditional world. A stone sinks in the water, the ripples go out and pacify, off into nothing, the stone sinks, and it's all over. This is the traditional world of the great chain of being. This poem outlines the whole thrust of the course, I think, rather neatly. Now look at the contrast with Cromwell. "Cromwell alone with greater vigor runs, sun-like the stage of succeeding suns. And still the day which he doth next restore is the just wonder of the day before. Cromwell alone doth with new luster spring and shines the jewel of the yearly ring." Cromwell doesn't operate in nature. Cromwell isn't subject to the great chain of being. He isn't in this heavy, sinking, sad world. Cromwell operates in sacred time. Cromwell operates in the heavens. Cromwell can move the earth. "'Tis he the scattered force of time contracts, and in one year the work of ages acts, while heavy monarchs make a wide return, longer and more malignant than Saturn. Though they all platonic years should reign, yet in the same posture would be found again." Monarchs guddling along, implementing the law, doing justice, gypping the people. Cromwell, in a year, does something totally different. Ireland like that, Scotland like that, the Netherlands are in our hands. The world will be rebuilt. Cromwell isn't like a regular monarch and doesn't have to be legitimated like a regular monarch. He operates in a whole new providential apocalyptic dimension. Let's drop down a few lines to about line 34. He says, talking about regular kings, he says, "They neither build the temple in their days," that's the temple at the end of days, "nor matter for succeeding founders raise, nor sacred prophecies consult within, much less themselves to perfect them begin." What don't regular monarchs do? They don't fulfill the apocalypse. They don't build the temple. They're schnooks. They're operating out there where it doesn't count. "No other care they bear of things above, but with astrologers divine of Jove, to know how long their planet yet reprieves from the deserved fate their guilty lives. They talk to astrologers and say, how long am I going to live? They don't say, what's going to happen on earth? Thus image-like and useless time they tell. They're clockwork figures. You know, you think of a great clock, say, in Munich. They walk out and they do their little act and they don't do anything. And with vain scepter strike the hourly bell. No more contribute to the state of things than wooden heads do to vile strings. They're sort of the head that you play the strings on. They don't do anything. While indefatigable Cromwell hies and cuts his way still nearer to the skies, learning a music in the region clear, that's the music of the spheres, to tune this lower to that higher sphere, Cromwell is making heaven on earth. He is making the music of the eternal heavens the reality below the moon. And then they go to compare him with Amphion, a classical figure who could strike his lyre and bring stones out of the quarry to build the great temple. And that goes on, we won't have a chance to read it right now, to talk about how he builds a temple in England that will be the temple at the end of days. All of these people who disagree, the levelers, the diggers, the royalists, the Presbyterians, the independents, the Baptists, the unbelievers, all who have 1,000 different voices and 1,000 different agendas, Cromwell will bring them together and make counterweights of their voices and of their attitudes and their programs and create the great temple. He will create the great polity at the end of days. And once he's stabilized England, once he's integrated all the populations, take a look on page 129 of the Penguin edition, line 99. When for his foot he thus at place had found, he hurls since the world about him round, and in his several aspects like a star he shines in peace, and thither shoots in war, while by his beams observing princes steer and wisely court the influence they fear. The princes out there say, oh my God, what is this? What is this new republic? We had best try to get along with him. And then Marvell adds, oh, would they rather by his pattern one, that is to be like him, kiss the approaching, not yet angry sun, the Son of Man who's coming, and in their numbered footsteps humbly tread the path where holy oracles do lead. What we want to do is follow Scripture and where the world is really going. How might they under such a captain raise the great designs kept for the latter days? If Cromwell could lead the world, we would have the millennium. And, it says in the poem, he will. He's not subject to the great chain of being. He's not subject to custom. He's not subject to fortune. He operates as now the English Republic operates in a whole new dimension. But the princes of Europe, he says, but mad with reason, miscalled of state, they think they're just in terms of regular politics, they know him not, and what they know not hate. They still sing Hosanna to the whore, and her whom they should massacre adore. It's the whore of Babylon. They should bring down Rome, and they don't realize that. Drop down two more lines. He says, unhappy princes, ignorantly bred, by malice some, by errors more misled, if gracious heaven to my life gives strength, leisure to time and to my weakness strength, then shall I once with graver accents shake your regal sloth and your long slumbers wake, like the shrill huntsman that prevents the east, that anticipates the east, winding his horn to the kings that chase the beast. The sun is about to rise in the east, and just before the sun rises, there gallops across the fields a man sounding the horn. And who is that man? That man is Oliver Cromwell. That agency is the English Republic. Till then my muse shall hollow from behind, I'll call out, angelic Cromwell, who outwings the wind, and in dark nights and in cold days alone pursues the monster through every throne, which shrinking to her Roman den impure, gnashes her gory teeth, nor there secure. What's Cromwell going to do? He will defeat the enemies of the true faith. He will convert the enemies of the fool of the true faith, and he will lead the world to the second coming, to the millennium. The Republic has a messianic destiny, and Marvell and Cromwell both accept this. He ends the poem with the line, or a set of lines, let me just quote them quickly, you don't have them perhaps right at hand, it's right at the end of the poem. He says, "Up from the other world his flame he darts, and princes shining through their windows starts. Cromwell, like the sun, comes through the latticework windows of the kings of the world, who their suspected counselors refuse and credulous ambassadors accuse." They don't really understand what's going on. "Is this, saith one," that's one king, "the nation that we read, spent with both wars, two civil wars, under a captain dead," that's Charles, "yet rig a navy, for we dress us late. Before we get our pants on, they've got it all together. And ere we dine, raise and rebuild the state. Before I have my breakfast, there's a whole new regime out there, the British Republic. What oaken forests, what golden mines, what mints of men, what union of designs. The British Republic under Cromwell is not subject to the slow, sinking, tedious world of nature. It operates in the realm of grace, and it will change the face of the earth. It will create the new era. It will defeat the Antichrist. It will bring the age of justice and righteousness to men." A tall order for the British Republic. You get something of that attitude in the poem called To His Coy Mistress. This is a poem about convincing a lady to be friendlier, let me put it that way. It was banned in Tennessee because of its title. And it has some of the politics that I've just described. Maybe I could read just the opening lines and we could take a quick look at that. It begins, "Had we but world enough and time, this coyness lady were no crime. We would sit down and think which way to talk and pass our long love's day. Thou, by the Indian Ganges side, should rubies find." The Ganges in India, that's the end of the world. "I, by the tide of Humber, would complain." The Humber is near where he's writing the poem, in northern England, and his father had the year before drowned in it, so that's his complaint. So the contrast is the Ganges, way the hell over there, the Humber, right where we are. We don't know if there's a real lady involved in this or not. He said, "I would love you 10 years before the flood," I mean way back in the time of Noah, "and you should, if you please, refuse to the conversion of the Jews." The conversion of the Jews is now. That's the contrast. What's going to happen at the end of days? Far away, near, long ago, now. He's talking to the lady, saying, "Time is short, dear. The apocalypse is nearby." I don't know if any lady would be persuaded by that. You might reflect on it. The world is wrapping up. But as the protectorate grew older in its later years, it grew more conservative. It grew more monarchical. Cromwell never took the crown, but his image was that much more of a prince. And against him would emerge an organized, coherent Republican opposition. A Republican opposition that talked about an extended franchise, and in some ways, with some of these leaders, a franchise very near to that of the Levellers. The most outstanding individual for this was a man called James Harrington. Along with Hobbes, Harrington is the most significant theorist of the English Revolution. the most influential theorist, let me add, for the American Revolution in the next century than any English writer, even John Locke. He is the great Republican thinker of the 17th century. And although his background is utterly aristocratic, the franchise he proposed was not that far off that of the Levellers. His most important work was called The Commonwealth of Oceania, published in 1656. Its purpose is to try to make Cromwell institute, like the legislator, the Great Republic. He wants the Great Republic, not an encroaching monarchy. It's against the coming conservatism of the period. What is Harrington's analysis of the English Revolution? He says, Henry VIII, with the Reformation, with the dissolution of the monasteries, ended up distributing at bargain basement prices a huge amount of monastic land to small farmers. You created, he said, a yeoman class in England. And in so distributing property, and specifically landed property, you shifted the balance of power within England. You created a society of citizen farmers. Now, the king didn't mean to do that. It was unwitting. But that's what happened. And this, he says, is incompatible with feudal monarchy. There has thus been a shift of property, a shift in the structure of society, and that is what brought down the king. That's why a monarchy is a bad idea. It's bad for English society, given the way it's built. Land equals power. Land transformed the English monarchy and led to the English Revolution. Change the property structure, and you will change the kind of government you've got. It lasted as long as it did, in large part because of the charm of Queen Elizabeth. Elizabeth was a charming lady. Well, that depends. The elderly Queen Elizabeth, that would be an acquired taste for her charm. She kept getting increasingly suspicious of people. But that's Harrington's argument. She held the monarchy together by her charm, by dealing with the House of Commons, by being coy, by threatening on the one hand and giving out patents on the other. But she could only do that so long. And after a while, the monarchy could not continue. What we're in, said Harrington, is a whole new world. The classical world of the Republic is the world we're now really dealing with. The classical world with a classical citizen exercising civic virtue and with a larger sense of community is what is necessary for England now, not Cromwell's proto-monarchy. Why did Rome decline? Rome declined because Roman generals created for themselves great latifundia, great estates with people dependent on them personally. That killed the Republic. That killed the civic spirit. That killed the idea of the citizen. The decline of the public spirit and the rise of the great estates is what brought down Rome. That, by the way, is a thesis that no less than Arnold Toynbee had, in fact, advanced. This is not just a silly idea. It brought the end of the Republic. It established the empire. It made the civic ideal erode. But this erosion was made far worse by the coming of the barbarians, who were similarly settled on public lands and looked to a personal protector and personal ties for the authority in society. This created what he calls the feudal world. This created what he also calls the modern prudence, that is to say, feudalism. The Reformation enabled people to escape from the modern prudence, to restore classical citizenship and the democratic republic. What he wants, and he's very upfront about this, is a land-owning, armed citizen soldier on his farm. Echoes of that may sound close to home indeed. This is the new property structure, and this must be a democracy. Where Winstanley said the way to get democracy was, in fact, to collectivize property, we have with Harrington a whole new sociology of history. Solve the problem with the idea of the size and the shape of property distribution. Decision-taking, he said, was something more. It wasn't just the property that was distributed. Republics were not just a kind of government. Rather, if you created a republic, the relationship of making a policy and agreeing to that policy, that dynamic of politics, mirrored the relationship of the body to the soul in every individual. It mirrored the relationship of heaven and earth. Thus, there is something sacred about the republic. Republics aren't secular. Republics are religious. Harrington saw politics as a religious act, politics through which the soul and the body became one, through which heaven and earth became one. The model for this, and here he agreed completely with the ultra-radical Gerard Winstanley, was the Hebrew Commonwealth, which had indeed been a democratic republic, not with collective property, but with citizen-soldier small landowners. The democratic republic was God's revelation to man, because that's what salvation really means. But the Jews learned by revelation from God, he went on to say. The Romans and the Greeks learned from nature, came up with the same truth. The overthrow of the democratic citizen-soldier republic came with Saul. It was a revolt against God. And once again, thus, Israel, republican Israel, democratic Israel, is the promise. England is its fulfillment. We need the classical citizen. Politics equal religion. Republic equals salvation. Democracy equals theocracy, because after all, it is the priesthood of all believers. England truly is a nation of prophets. If we look at what happened historically with the Jews, Moses created democratic congregationalism. This is not typically how that scripture is read, but it can be read that way. What happened was, an oligarchic Sanhedrin set up the equivalent of Presbyterianism. And from that equivalent came the high priest Hillel, who was the first pope. Jesus came as a reformer to restore lay liberty lost to the Jews. Christ's mission is proto-Lutheran. It is an attack against the pope. It's an attack against the first papacy. Only the free republic can be Christian, because only the free republic integrates the personality where the soul and the body become one. And thus the Judeo-Christian apocalypse leads directly, inescapably, to the Greco-Roman polis. The Emperor Tiberius' killing of the Roman Republic came at the same time as the killing of Christ in Judea. Moreover, Harrington makes a very big deal out of the fact that Paul is a Roman citizen. What does Paul do? He goes around setting up ecclesias. That's not churches. That's not congregations. That's a mistranslation. In fact, it is a mistranslation. He sets up little republics. What Paul and Christianity are doing is going out creating citizens, going out creating little republics around the Roman Empire. That's the purpose of the whole thing. Harrington is the first man to use the word priestcraft, that great phrase of the Enlightenment. Harrington outraged orthodoxy on a whole range of reasons, and you can easily understand why. For one thing, he said that Christianity did not supplant Judaism or classical culture, but was its fulfillment. They aren't abrogated, they're part of where we are. Christ and Luther look like remarkably similar people. They are great political reformers. In the end, we end up with this. We end up with the kingdom of Christ equaling the democratic republic, the saint equaling the citizen, Christian liberty equaling political liberty, redemption equaling political action. False religion is corruption in politics, leading to hierarchy, dependence, subservience, clientage, where you can't make moral judgments, where you can't be a man, where you can't be a Christian. The conclusion is that Harrington sounds remarkably secular. Friedrich Engels would be fascinated by his books. He really would be. The phrase priestcraft is indeed a phrase of the Enlightenment. But the democratic republic, the saint and the citizen is in fact the result of the apocalypse. It is the Messianic Republic.